Thank you. Building on our co-panelists' comments, I would like to talk a little bit about, you know, this question of why is it that South Korea is so, I don't know, feel, let's put it in a diplomatic term, feel very strongly about, you know, these historical issues and about Japan. And before I actually get to do that, I wanted to point out, you know, President, former President Lee Myung-bak called for an apology from the emperor. Even the South Korean media, I believe it was editorial from Joseon-Ilbo, you know, they usually follow the dominant conservative narrative. You know, Joseon-Ilbo even thought that, you know, the president even too far. So just put it out there. So, you know, when we think about the South Korean position on these various historical issues, you know, we tend to think of this in terms of South Korean identity that led them to behave the way that they do. But then in terms of consequences of these, disputes that we are witnessing today, I am concerned about actually what Mike was talking about, this narrative and also the public opinion. I'm worried that the hardening of image of the other in the minds of many public, you know, peoples of South Korea and Japan. So I have a paper that I co-authored with one of our PhD students, basically trying to understand the link between these historical territorial issues and South Korean identity, particularly with reference to Tokto Takeshima Island issue. So we looked at education, so we looked at all the high school history textbooks, about 7 or 8 that are being used in South Korea. And then we also looked at civil society, NGO groups. And then we also looked at the media reporting about, you know, the bilateral relations. And what we found out is that over the years, in recent years, typically we think of South Korean identity being responsible for, you know, South Korean reaction to Japan. But what has happened in terms of the disputes, what we found out is that, in fact, these disputes and how these actors respond to these disputes are actually reproducing South Korean identity, linking, say, Tokto Takeshima island issue to South Korean sense of patriotism. This may not actually be new, but when we looked at how it has become much more prevalent to see everyday symbols in South Korea. So you have a t-shirt that says, I love Tokto, you know, and then of course the song, Tokto is our land, is like legendary. Any South Korean who grew up in South Korea will hear that. If you actually take a look at the lyrics, it's like, you know, those are not the things that's going to go to academic publications, you know. Just briefly, when we looked at high school history textbooks, in fact, Tokto Takeshima's issue was the one that received most attention of all the historical and territorial issues. And then the message that comes from the narrative analysis is that, you know, they will talk about this, you know, fishermen in Joseon Dynasty that, you know, went to protest against the Japanese authorities about the Japanese ship, what was the exact story, violating Korean sovereignty. And basically the message that the high school students are getting is that you have to protest when infringe upon sovereignty is going to take place. And, you know, some of the keywords and narratives that come out of these historical textbooks are actually quite similar to what we will hear in media. And second, when we analyze the media, the dominant framing that the reports on Japan is based on is that conflict, you know, framing. Basically, when Japan does wonderful things, it doesn't really get a lot of attention in news media, you know, but when someone has to say some provocative things about historical issues, you know, someone was likening the comfort woman, you know, issue to college cafeteria, you know, things like that. Those, you know, negative stories that are very provocative receives most attention, and these are actually well documented in media studies as well. And then civil society, there are at least five major NGOs that are dedicated to promote South Korean position amongst the South Korean public. So the message is almost becoming like, if you are a good South Korean, you know, your loyalty to the state comes from your support for the position, you know, South Korean position on this Tokto Takeshima Island. So these are actually, I think much of it actually comes from this social justice, you know, that things are not, things that were not being fair were done and we have to do something about it. But at the same time, these are worrisome because this reproduces that identity or South Korean patriotism that sets up Japan as the other. So there has to be, again, narrative that counters, you know, these narratives. And it was interesting to note that when we think about South Korean position towards these territorial and historical issues, we tend to think of South Korea as one actor. But we noted that it was in fact the civil society and the bottom up that criticized the South Korean government position for being weak, and the civil society, they were the one who were much more, in a sense, aggressive in promoting the South Korean position. So, and there's a lot of popular culture around this, seems, you know, and very popular South Korean singer, I thought it was interesting, he, you know, he would actually publish an advertisement in New York Times, you know, to promote South Korean position. So all these little, you know, cultural products and cultural phenomena has been, you know, ingrained and kind of embraced in this, you know, Japan-South Korea relations. We somehow need to find a way to shift the narratives. So in my own way, whenever I try and write about, you know, Japan, its relations with South Korea and elsewhere, I mean, it's one thing that as in public intellectual criticize, you know, things that we do not believe create value, but it's quite another that we actually have to be fair. You have to be balanced in terms of reporting and writing about the relations. So I'll stop here.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights. I really learned a lot about this issue, important Japan-South Korea relations in crisis. Is it? it doesn't, you know, we don't have to think that it's a crisis for long. But I think for me, I think there are four major common themes that I found in based on our speaker's remarks today. And one is domestic politics, and second is, well, different historical narratives, not just between Japan and South Korea, but within South Korea, between progressives and conservatives. And then third, North Korean factor. And then fourth, I guess, divergent democracies. I think these are all extremely, extremely important issues. For me as a historian, I think this having different historical narratives, I mean, any country, we do have different historical narratives, and these are all constructed, but I think this is one of the things that would be most challenging things to sort of, reconcile between the two countries. Okay, without further ado, I think I'll open the floor. But please identify yourself before you ask your questions, or I'll start with this.
Thank you for your talks. I am Munehito Nakatani from, I'm a grad student from Georgetown University. My question is mainly directed to Professor Mochizuki. So at the end of your talk, you were mentioning about the proposal for a foundation, which reminded me of the 2015 agreement between the Park administration and the Abe administration about establishing a foundation on the comfort women issue. So, I, at that time, I was also surprised that, you know, a conservative government would agree to that kind of accord. So how would you analyze that event and also, you know, the breakdown of that recently? And also, like, if any reconciliatory actions were to occur further on, I guess a sense from a Japanese point of view is that, I guess, a sense of mistrust towards South Koreans would be that these agreements would not be sustainable. So how could Japan and both South Japan and South Korea strive to make these kinds of reconciliatory efforts sustainable? Thank you.
I remember, I believe it was in January 2016 that there was a conference at the Wilson Center, and we dissected that agreement. And I remember then that I was very skeptical that this agreement would stick. And the argument that I made for this, I mean, there were many flaws with that agreement. I admire the effort of the diplomats on both sides who worked hard to iron this out despite the major divide, because I remember 18 months before that there was very little will for that. And so I don't want to diminish the work and the achievement, but I think it was fundamentally flawed. And one is that it was clear that for this agreement to stick, it had to get the support, the public support of the major civil society umbrella organization that was representing some of the Comfort Women survivors. Not all, but some of the Comfort Women survivors. And when the issue of the statue of the young girl at the Japanese embassy and so became such a prominent part of that agreement, I thought that this would make it very hard for the Korean Council to accept. On top of that, the major problem around the Comfort Women issue was Mr. Abe's attitude towards the Kono statement and him being one of the leaders of a movement to try to overturn the Kono statement. And I thought that was a terrible move. And so for this agreement to actually do the work that it was supposed to do to promote reconciliation in South Korea, I've always thought it was Prime Minister Abe who needed to be in front of the public expressing his apology. But it was the two foreign ministers who did this. There was no kind of follow-up in terms of a personal letter of apology from the Prime Minister. So I think that limited things. And then the other is that, and this is where I have, you know, major disagreements with some of my friends in Japan. When they ask, well, when is this over? How many times do we have to apologize? What is the compensation? And then when can we close the books? And I never believe that the process of reconciliation can be approached in that fashion. It is an ongoing process to build trust based on empathy. And a key part of this is remembrance and education. And that's the part that is missing, the acknowledgement of remembrance and education. And I was elated that Prime Minister Abe included that in his very kind of ambiguous statement on August 14th, 2015. But unfortunately, I see no effort by the Japanese government to go and promote that. I mean, I think it would have been great to have kept the Asian Women's Fund going at full throttle so that scholars could study the issue, exchange views, because this is a very complicated history. And so when I talk about this revised proposal to deal with this latest issue of conscripted labor. It's not just about an apology or a compensation, but it's really doing kind of historical research, disentangling the complexity of this to the point that the people of South Korea and Japan could have a shared history, and the debates will not be between South Koreans and Japanese, but it will be debates that will cross-cut countries. And this is the fundamental problem which I think Japanese elites have not focused on.
Patrick Park with The Voice of America. I guess my question is directed to Professor Mochizuki again. How does the strained relationship between these two countries affect the U.S. interest and security in the region, especially in regards to the denuclearization of North Korea?
Well, I mean, I think it affects U.S. strategic interests, and you know, I hope others will chime in on this, because I, you know, I certainly don't have the wisdom on this. You know, I think if we are going to deal with denuclearization in North Korea, and I'm very critical of what has happened over the last few weeks, and the way the Trump administration or dealt with the Hanoi summit, but having said that, I think the best possibility to move North Korea in a direction that we want is for there to be very close cooperation between Japan, South Korea, and the United States. So I think that that's fundamental. And then when one looks into the future, then I think it's in America's interest that the Japanese and the South Koreans really, you know, develop a sense of mutual trust and close cooperation. Now, I think the Obama administration had a very skillful light touch in promoting this. I'm somewhat skeptical of whether the current U.S. administration can address this in such a skillful fashion. But I think the need to do it this time is even greater than it was during the Obama administration.
Yeah, let me actually add on to that. Throughout this, I guess, a descent of the Japan-ROK relations since, you know, for the last 12, 18 months, what you notice is a kind of a notable absence of U.S. in terms of the U.S. has never been active in terms of mediating the two, but U.S. has been the forcing function, the presence of the U.S., and U.S. keeps saying, we need three of us to work together to promote denuclearization of North Korea, oftentimes has worked as a forcing function for Japan and ROK to come together and have a practical dialogue about how to address this security challenge. And in all practicality, if we are serious about denuclearizing North Korea, Japan would have to come into play, financial assistance-wise, technical assistance-wise. Japan's role will be important over the long term. But the notable absence of the U.S., not only that very bilateral alliance management approach that this administration has been taking, is, I would say, indirectly affecting the affecting or impeding the you know, disincentivizing Tokyo and Seoul to work together, or, you know, try to reconcile some of those disagreements.
Thank you very much. That's giving me the attractive chance. Let me ask a very simple, hypothetical, but challenging and practical question. Suppose a situation where some emergency happens in the Korean Peninsula. The United States wants you know, Japanese maritime self-defense force to be involved. But the bank insists that it should come with the sunrise flag, which Korea hates a lot, saying that this is a legal requirement, and this even related to the morale of the soldiers to be involved. But South Korea insists that Japanese vessels with the sunrise flag should not come the Korean Peninsula. They want the United States, would you or should you? First, are you persuading Japan to drop the flag? Second, are you persuading Korea to accept the flag? Or third, you are just give up, you know, the involving Japan.
Is anybody can answer?
I hate those questions, but I'm gonna try. Oh, Miba-san. My instinct would be for the U.S. in this case, U.S. Indo-PACOM would probably forwarding some of their leadership by then to probably to Japan. That. Even before public of those two countries are reading about JMSDF with the you know vessels requesting you know sunrise flag going in and public you know Republic of Korea government resisting before this becomes a public knowledge, I would hope that Indo-PACOM will stronger on both sides to say just do it. This is what needs to be done. Because otherwise, the defense of your country is at stake, so you choose.
I'm going to go out on a limb, but I would try to convince the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force to not have the Rising Sun flag. I think the Hinomaru is a beautiful flag, and that should be enough. For the morale of the sailors on those ships, I think it would be terrible if that is what stands in the way of Japan participating in some joint operation.
Celeste or
Chiang,
you want to add anything? No. Okay.
this is my field.
Yes.
Shihoko Goto with the Wilson Center. A question to Professor Lee. There is a lot of concern about free trade regimes in the region. Specifically, there are the CPTPP is currently in play, and South Korea is seeking to actually become a member of that agreement. There is also a free trade agreement under RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, which both Japan and South Korea are a member of, as well as China. Could aspirations for these two trade regimes, trade agreements, actually be as strong a source of unity for South Korea and Japan to replace something like a division in approaching the North Korea situation? Or is that too weak a concern?
Thank you. Trade is not my areas of expertise, but I will try my best. And please, other co-panelists, please feel free to jump in if that's okay. I am thinking about past efforts, you know, where Japan and South Korea, for example, had currency swap, and then you know some of the regional arrangements, Chiangmai initiatives and whatnot, and then the fate of these you know cooperative economic arrangement, actually they were, in my view, influenced negatively by the rising political tensions between the two countries. So. I would hope that these will actually, you know, be a force that could sustain the, and actually will incentivize and activate some of the actors, you know, business community, for example, to be able to, you know, somehow push the government towards the direction of working together with Japan. But I also noted that, you know, Japan and South Korea have been talking about free trade agreements. And then they resume negotiations when they are actually doing the talks. But then the minute some historical issue comes, you know, comes up, then they just pull up all the way down to school trips and all that. So in my view, although it's not what I would like to see. These trade deals and arrangements have been influenced by the political circumstances. That's why I think politics actually has to get it right, because trade, at the end of the day, as a political scientist, also it's very much about politics, isn't it? Yes.
I agree.
Christian Cray, Norman Cray Foundation. So I have a question really a bit more about the future of everything in that, as well as the geopolitical concerns, maybe the next 5 years. Technology is changing hugely. Possibly the Arctic Circle, you know, could have a huge influence on climate one way or another. At the end of the day, 2/3 of the population of the world live in Asia. And it seems to me in all of this, if Japan would come out with a strong, positive vision to invite other countries in over the next year or so, it has these huge opportunities, both with the new emperor celebrating the 195 nations, with the Olympics coming. There are so many possibilities for a positive way forward. Is there any possibility that these things could go right, and how could we all be helping to make these things go right?
Well, you know, I'll take an initial stab at that important but difficult question. You know, first I would say that there is both an opportunity but also a need for Japan to do that. And in addition to those very important issues about global warming and other environmental issues, there is, I think, the shadow of the intensifying rivalry between the United States and China. And I think most countries on China's periphery would not want to choose between the United States and China. I think Japan, when really came, you know, when forced to, I mean, they will of course pick the U.S. Japan alliance over some form of Chinese primacy. But they too, the Japanese, do not want a dangerous rivalry between the United States and China. So I think there's a real need for Japan to work with neighboring countries to, you know, what one astute Japanese scholar has called to create a regional infrastructure that is apart from the U.S.-China relationship to serve as a stabilizing foundation for the future of Asia. Now, Japan has done a lot of great work with the ASEAN countries and now with South Asia as part of the free and open Indo-Pacific, but that one piece, a critical piece in Northeast Asia, Korea, is missing. And so I don't know how long Prime Minister Abe will stay in office. If he does stay in office for a fourth term, I hope he can see the strategic value of that. And if he doesn't stay in office, I hope that whoever the next Prime Minister is will really focus on that.